So when we think of becoming a monastic, the kind of root thing that comes to mind is holding precepts. And the Buddha established different types of precepts, different levels of precepts for us according to where we are in the path. There's three basic broad levels of what's called the Pratimoksha precepts, or the individual liberation precepts. And the second is the Bodhisattva, and the third Bodhisattva precepts, and the fourth, second is the Bodhisattva vow, and the third is the Tantric vow. Okay, so we're working on that first set, the Pratimoksha, or self-liberation vows. There's different, different traditions say it's called self-liberation for different reasons. The Tibetans etymologize it as you take those precepts with the wish to liberate yourself from cyclic existence. So it's for your own liberation. The Chinese say the etymology is that self refers to each precept, and so you are liberating yourself from the fault of each of those actions when you keep the precepts. Because it's called, sometimes instead of self, it's individual liberation. That makes more sense if we say instead of self-liberation, individual liberation. So Tibetans say individual as in your own liberation, not the liberation of others. And the Chinese say liberation, individual, meaning each individual fault. You know, that you're liberated from each of those by keeping the precepts. Within the Pratimoksha, or individual liberation precepts, there are different categories of precepts. Okay? You have a full ordination for men and women. Okay? You have a probationary ordination for women. Then you have the novice ordination for men and women. Okay, so that's five, and five types of ordination so far. And then you have the male and female lay followers ordination, so that's seven. And then the eighth one is the one-day vows, where you take eight precepts for one day. So right now we're talking about what's called in Sanskrit upasaka, or upasika vows, the precepts that you take as a lay person. Because you start with those, okay? So you start training with those five precepts, and then sometimes taking the eight precepts, you kind of, because you take the eight precepts for one day. So you take that, and then you go on to the novice precepts, and then from there you go on to the full ordination. The women have an intermediate ordination in there. Okay, so the best way to start is with the five precepts. Usually the five precepts are taken for life. In our situation, you know, if people want to do that at the end of the program, make a request and then we'll do the ceremony again. So you can take them for life. But for the course of the program, what you're going to do is take them from now until September 1st. So it's the program plus a week that will help you maintain your energy for the week after you leave. And it will give you some experience in living within the precepts. Because there's many benefits that accrue to living in precepts. So this will give you some taste of what it's like, the benefits and the challenges. Okay. So in terms of the benefits, just by keeping the precepts, we are purifying karma, and in particular preventing the ripening of one karmic effect, which is the tendency to do the negative action again. Okay? You know, because when we create negative karma, it has four different effects. One effect is you have the tendency to do it again. So that's really bad news. And I'd say that's like the worst effect, because you know, you just keep doing it, so you keep creating more and more negative karma. So when you take the precept, what you're doing is cutting that off, because you're making a determination not to do it again. Okay? So you're purifying that karmic result of doing it again. You're also creating a lot of positive karma by keeping the precepts, because every minute that you're not breaking them, you are keeping them, so you're accumulating that merit or positive potential. So let's say there's two people in the room right now. One of them has the precept not to kill and steal, and the other one doesn't. Both are sitting in the room. Neither one of them are killing and stealing. But the person who's taken the precept, you know, is actively not killing and stealing by the power of their intention. So they're accumulating good karma because of that. Whereas the person who doesn't have the precept, even though they're not doing those actions, they're missing out on the good karma, because they don't have the force of that intention. They don't have the what we call a precept body that helps them refrain from these negative actions. Okay, so you get, you know, these are really very outstanding benefits. And as you keep precepts longer and longer, you begin to feel this kind of basis underneath you, and it's the basis of something stable and solid in your life, which is your ethical conduct by keeping the precepts. So it really adds a lot of stability to your life and clarity. And then also the precepts function to make us so much more mindful and aware of what we're doing. Yeah, because we've made certain promises not to do certain actions, then we don't want to just act haphazardly this way and that way. You know, we want to make sure that we keep our promises. And so that makes us very, very aware of, well, what am I doing at any particular moment? What am I doing, and why am I doing that? So that's quite important for us. And you really see as many things that maybe, you know, you weren't very aware of doing before. Now when you have a precept, it's like, there's a tendency to do that action a lot. Now, for example, with the precept to avoid lying, part of lying includes exaggerating. Okay? We exaggerate a lot, don't we? You know, we tell stories, and we just kind of hype them up so they sound better than they are. Yeah? But that's actually a kind of lying. You know, when we have that precept, it makes us aware of that. Sometimes we lie to ourselves. You know, we don't tell ourselves the truth about something. We make up all sorts of excuses for our behavior. Sometimes we lie to ourselves by telling ourselves that we're worthwhile and useless and unlovable. And that's also lying. Okay? So, you know, when we have this precept not to lie, it makes us much more aware of the stories we tell ourselves and others, and makes us question why we tell those stories. Okay? So it really makes us so much more aware and mindful of what we're doing. You know, incredible benefit comes from that. Yeah? And then also when you hold precepts, then you have a community of people that you hold the precepts with. You know, you have your Dharma friends, you have your Dharma teacher. There's a supportive community. And so you don't feel like you're kind of lost in outer space with your spiritual wish, but, you know, there's a group of people that you practice together with, and that's really very, very beneficial. Okay? Now, at the same time, when we take precepts, we have the challenge of keeping them, yeah? Because we've made promises, and so we have to kind of put more energy into trying to keep them instead of just behaving any old way. Now, I've got to say here that the reason we take the precepts is that we can't keep them perfectly. If we were able to keep them perfectly, we wouldn't need to take them. So we take them because we can't keep them perfectly, and because trying to keep them well helps us, you know, decide and get some clarity about our behavior. Okay? So don't feel, you know, we're making a promise to keep these. But when transgressions occur, don't just kind of throw up your hands and say, I foiled with the whole job and it's no use, so I quit. You know, that's not the proper attitude. But to realize that we take these as training guidelines that help our mind, and they help our mind a lot. And of course, sometimes we slip up. So when we slip up, then we do purification. Okay, so, you know, in the evenings you're doing prostrations, you're doing Vajrasattva, and so that has the purification practice of regret, taking refuge in generating bodhicitta, making a determination to avoid it again, and then doing some remedial action like the mantra, prostration, something like that. So you do purification, and then you learn from it, and you go on in your life. And so in that way, the precepts really benefit. Yeah? So it's this line of like putting in effort, putting in mindfulness, you know, not being just sloppy in how we act, but at the same time, not being so tense and nervous that, you know, we're like this, and you know, and it takes the joy out of our life, and also not being so hard on ourselves that instead of learning from our mistakes, we just waste our time beating ourselves up because we didn't, you know, do something. Okay. So we really want to learn when we make mistakes. Okay. So taking any kind of precepts depends first on taking refuge. Okay, so refuge means that we're entrusting our spiritual guidance to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And having entrusted our spiritual guidance to them, then that indicates that we want to follow their advice. And the first advice the Buddha gives is, you know, get your life together. Yeah? And so the best way to get our life together is to stop doing these five activities that are involved in the lay followers or upasaka precepts. Okay, and so some of these activities are the things that, you know, religion, many religions advise us not to do. And there's some good reasons that, you know, for advising us not to do them. Okay, so if we take a look at the precepts, you know, the first one is killing. You know, so most religions, you know, talk about that. However, some religions just say don't kill a human being, whereas Buddhism talks about not killing any sentient being. So that includes animals, it includes insects. Okay, so that makes us, you know, very, very careful about how we relate to all the various insects and different animals around us in this environment, and really helps us to cultivate the mind that cherishes life and wants to protect life. And so we can see that when we keep this precept, this is our personal contribution to world peace. Because it means every sentient being that we come in contact with doesn't need to be afraid for their life. Yeah, that's pretty powerful, I think. You know, what would have happened if Adolf Hitler had this one precept? Yeah? What would have happened if Mao Zedong had this one precept? Pretty powerful when one person stops killing. Okay? So, you know, we shouldn't poo-poo the force of this precept. You know, saying, well, I'm just one person, it won't bring world peace. It can bring a lot of peace. Yeah, just ourselves as one individual, not killing. Okay? And then, on the contrary to killing, then really trying to respect life, cherish life, protect life. You know, so when we see insects or animals in distress, you know, yesterday a wasp flew into my yogurt. Yeah, I kind of rescued him from the yogurt, but I couldn't wipe the yogurt off of his wings. You know, but you know, just some of these things, just small things about, you know, different ways of protecting life. And then the second precept is to avoid stealing. So this means taking things that haven't been freely offered to us. You know, so we can all say, oh yes, breaking into people's house in the middle of the night is bad. You know, we're not going to do that. But do we take things that haven't been given to us? Yeah. You know, sometimes we'll work at a business and we'll use office supplies of the business for our own personal use, or we'll make long distance calls on the business telephone, but they're personal calls, or we'll lie about our income tax, or we'll borrow something and then deliberately forget to return it and think that it's ours. So, or we'll even use things, you know, like around here, you know. Oh, well, the Abbey won't mind if I use this. The Abbey won't mind if I go in the kitchen at 3 a.m. and get some food. Well, if it's not freely offered, it's, you know, actually transgressing the precept. And so then the contrary to this is respecting other people's property and protecting their property. And again, we can see that if we do this even as one individual, it has a very powerful effect, because again, it means everybody who comes in contact with us doesn't need to worry about us ripping off their stuff. Now, it means people can leave money places. Not that we should do that, but you know, if we should do it, or you know, we can leave things in our room and we can trust that nobody is going to take stuff and claim it as their own. Okay, so we really learn to respect others' property, respect the ownership, ask permission before we use things. I mean, we shouldn't carry this to too much of an extreme. When I was visiting my parents last time, I needed a pen. My pen ran out of ink, and I wanted to take a couple of pens with me. And I asked my mom if I could take a couple of ballpoint pens, and she looked at me like I was absolutely nuts, you know. And I realized, okay, in our family, you know, we have the thing that on things like ballpoint pens and tubes of toothpaste and tea bags and stuff like that, that we can take it. You know, I don't need to ask for that. But if I were going to take something else, you know, that was larger, that they held as more valuable, then I should definitely ask. Okay. Then the third one is to avoid unwise sexual behavior. What we're going to do from now until September 1st is celibacy, because it just makes things much, much clearer, much easier. Okay, unwise sexual behavior usually refers to, the strict definition is adultery. In other words, if you're in a relationship and you go with somebody outside of your relationship, or even if you're single, you go with somebody who is in a relationship. That's the strict kind of meaning. But I think it actually means, it has more of the meaning of not using sexuality in an unkind way or an unwise way. Okay, so what are examples of unkind ways of using sexuality? Not caring about somebody and just having sex with them for your own gratitude, your own pleasure, without genuinely caring about that person or their feelings or how they might be responding to the situation. An example of unwise sexual contact would be not using birth control when you don't want to have a child, or not using rejection when there's a chance of sexually transmitted diseases. Okay, so it really calls on us to maybe take a little bit of an inventory about our sexual expression. In these days that we're here, and until September 1st, raising the bar a little bit and making it celibacy. And celibacy just makes things much, much clearer, you know, because when you're celibate, then you don't need to worry about attracting somebody. And you don't need to You know, there's so many trips. I'm sure you're all very aware of them. There's trips that go on when you're attracted to somebody. You know those trips. And like, you know, you walk in the room and are they looking at me? And how can I, you know, walk so that they're going to notice me, but it's not going to look like I'm trying to get them to notice me, you know? And how do I smile? And how do I use my eyes? And do I look at them when somebody cracks a joke? There's so many trips we do when we're sexually attracted to somebody that really kind of make relationships they're not very direct and honest, you know? Because we're kind of playing around, trying to present ourselves in a certain way. What kind of person do I think they think they will like, you know? So we're attracted to somebody, and then we try and guess what kind of person they will like. And then we try and become that person. Because if I can become the person I think they think they'll like, then they'll like me. You know, you getting what I'm saying? So, you know, forget about being ourselves and being natural. You know, we're just kind of sitting there in our, you know, our own trip about, you know, well, how am I going to present myself? And, you know, they like such and such, so I'm going to pretend I like this and that. And, you know, even though I don't, but, you know, I want them to like me, so I'll pretend I do. And we say all sorts of nice things to the person to get them to like us. And, I mean, there's just so many trips. And, you know, and then we're so, you know, how do I walk? And are they noticing? And, you know, all this, yeah? So it's really kind of a drag. And it just wastes so much energy. And it makes relationships so complicated. You know, because we're not being who we are. We're trying to be somebody else. And we're actually being very manipulative in the process. You know, we're not really relating straightforwardly to somebody else. We're trying to manipulate the situation. How can I get them to like me? So when we keep celibacy, then we just drop all of that. It makes everything so much simpler. You know, because you just relate to people as they are, and that's it. You're not trying to put on an image or look a certain way and comb your hair a certain way or wear a certain kind of clothes or, you know, drive a certain kind of car or talk in a certain way or any of that rubbish. So it allows us actually, instead of pouring so much attachment into one person, to establish a basis for developing genuine love for many people. So that's the third precept. And the fourth one is not lying. Okay, so this means not intentionally deceiving somebody. Now, of course, if a hunter comes on the land and says, you know, where do all the deer hang out? I want to go shoot one. You don't say, well, they're over there, you know. So, you know, we do use our wisdom in this situation. We don't have to lie, but we don't have to tell them the whole entire truth. There is such a thing as changing the topic, okay, or doing some other kind of thing where, you know, you just divert the attention. But to try as much as possible to be truthful with each other and to be truthful with ourselves, you know? So to be able to be honest when we've made a mistake and, you know, and acknowledge that. But also to be honest about our good qualities and not get hung up in putting ourselves down and telling ourselves that we're unworthy or unlovable or something like that. Okay? So really trying to be realistic and tell the truth. And at the Abbey especially, we're trying to create a quality of transparency, you know, where we can be much more relaxed with ourselves so that we feel okay saying whatever we need to say. Yeah, so, you know, because we all have things about ourselves that we don't like, that we don't want anybody to know. You know those things, you know? Might be things you think or things you've done, and, you know, you really hope nobody's clairvoyant because you don't want them to know, you know, what you've done and the horrible things that go through your mind and whatever. But what we're trying to cultivate is some kind of degree of self-acceptance so that we feel okay talking about these things. And that depends on a certain level of confidence within ourselves, and of course a certain level of trust, you know, with the people we're around. And so I think part of being truthful, you know, when we're willing to be truthful, then we're also letting other people know that they can trust us by being truthful themselves. Do you get what I mean? You know, like when I'm willing to say, you know, I blew it or I did this or that or whatever, and not kind of, you know, cower in terror about what you're going to think about me, then I'm trusting you, but I'm also letting you know that you can trust me and you can say what you need to say about whatever's going on with you. Yeah. And so some kind of quality of transparency like that. So the kind of thing we're trying to cultivate. And then the fifth precept is to avoid taking intoxicants. So this means alcohol and recreational drugs and tobacco. Okay? If you're on meds, take your meds. Okay? If you're on prescription medicine, take that. That's fine. Okay? What we're talking here about is alcohol. And I find it just better to keep the alcohol, this precept, very, very strictly. It makes for a lot of clarity. So not one drop of alcohol. Not one puff on a joint. Yeah, it just makes things very clear. Natalie and I were talking about that yesterday, and, you know, and she was saying she was with a cousin, and she just said, I don't drink, and that was it, you know? Whereas if you do it like, well, I'm not going to get intoxicated, then, you know, you never know if you've broken the precept until after you've broken it. Yeah? You're like, oh, I'm not intoxicated now, so I can take a little bit more. And then you take that little bit more, and then you realize you're intoxicated, and then you've broken your precept. So it's just much easier, you know, just nothing. Yeah, then very clear. Okay, so no alcoholic beverages, recreational drugs, you know, whatever people's, you know, each generation has their own drug of choice. It seems that marijuana permeates all the generations. But, you know, in my time, they didn't have crack cocaine, and, you know, we were too into acid. So, you know, but, you know, it's all kind of the same thing, yeah? So we give that up. And then also tobacco. So the reason for abandoning taking intoxicants is that when we take them, we lose the power of our discriminating wisdom, and we wind up making very poor choices. So they always tell the story in this regard of, you know, a monk who was being held prisoner by somebody, and this person said, either you kill this animal, or you go out and steal, or you sleep with this woman, or you lie about your attainments, or you go get drunk. And the monk said, well, getting drunk is the you know, kind of the lesser thing. You know, it doesn't directly harm anybody. So he went and got drunk, and then he did the other four. Yeah. But, you know, it sounds funny when you tell the story. But after, you know, I've had people come up and tell me, you know, that is actually what I've done in my life. You know, I've had people in retreats come up and say, that is exactly what I did in my life. I told myself it was okay to go drinking and drugging, and then I drank and drugged, and then I got involved in all sorts of other stuff. You know? And that's really what happens. Yeah? So if we're taking a lot of recreational drugs or alcohol, then I think we have to ask ourselves why we're taking it. You know, what's our motivation? What are we seeking? What are we looking for? Yeah. And this could be a very helpful, you know, introspection for us to do. Because sometimes we want to do it because everybody else is doing it and we don't want them to think that we're odd. Well, what's that? Yeah, attachment to reputation, isn't it? Yeah. Or sometimes we're doing it because we're bored. Well, does it help with being bored? You know? Or sometimes we're doing it because we don't like ourselves. But what do we feel like? How do we feel about ourselves after we're loaded? Do we like ourselves any better? No? So it's very helpful to really do a little bit of exploration here about, you know, well, why am I drinking? Or why am I drugging? What am I thinking I'm going to get out of this? Huh? And then seeing what comes up in that respect. It's very, very helpful. Okay? So that's about the precepts. And we're taking refuge, you know, in the ceremony here as a prerequisite to that. And Lama Yeshe, one of my first teachers, when he spoke about refuge, he, you know, because we usually think refuge is some kind of exotic thing. And he used to say, you're taking refuge all the time, dear. You know, refuge is, he used to call everybody dear. But he said, refuge is just seeking something that's going to help you with your problems. And he says, you're taking refuge all the time. And so when I began to look, well, you know, what do we usually take refuge in? Yeah. We take refuge in the refrigerator. Yeah. We take refuge in the shopping center. We take refuge in the television and the computer. Yeah. We take refuge in a lot of different things. Anything that's just going to take our mind, you know, and help us to ignore who we are. Yeah. And so this really obscures us from finding our own inner beauty, because, you know, it's coming from a good place where we're, you know, we're seeking an antidote to suffering. We're trying to find a way to be happy. But because nobody's ever taught us, we don't know the way to be happy. We don't know the way out of suffering. And so we take refuge in all these things that aren't going to bring us the happiness that we want, and that often just bring us more problems. Okay, so that's what a lot of the beginning part of this ceremony is about, is to get us to think of the things that we've taken refuge in our life. Okay, you know, we've taken refuge in material possessions, money, status, reputation, approval, praise, food, sex, music, and a myriad of other things. True or not true?
True.
True. Yeah. Where has it gotten us? Yeah. So, you know, here what we're trying to do when we take refuge is we're taking refuge in the Dharma is the real refuge, and it's the path out of misery. Yeah. So we're taking refuge in that path out of misery. Now we're taking refuge in the Buddha as the one who teaches us the path, and as the Sangha, and in the Sangha, here the Sangha refers to the people who have seen emptiness directly, who have some actual experience of the path, and so they're trustworthy guides for us. Okay, so that's just a little bit about what we're doing.